Baptists in America have probably done more for the cause of freedom than any other group of Christians anywhere in the world. They had the experiment of democracy and of republic here in America like they've never had anywhere else. Freedom of religion, the first island, the first colony that they helped found was Rhode Island, where it had freedom of religion, and they had a declaration that they could have freedom of religion there. And then the American Revolution started, and then they lost most of the rights. We're on page 236 in the second volume of John T. Christian's History of the Baptist Churches. Thoughtfully, they had considered what part of it would be proper to take in an unhappy contest, and had determined that they ought to make military resistance to Great Britain in her unjust invasion, tyrannical oppression, and repeated hostilities. They complained that, to a man, they were in favor of the revolution. Several Baptist preachers did great service in the army as chaplains. The Baptist General Association of Virginia sent in 1775 Jeremiah Walker, John Williams to preach to the soldiers. These were the most popular preachers in the Old Dominion. McClanahan raised a company chiefly composed of Baptists, whom he commanded as captain and preached to as a chaplain. Charles Thompson of Massachusetts served as chaplain for 3 years, and Hezekiah Smith was from the same state. J.M. Peck gives this following interesting account of the Hezekiah Smith. Dr. Smith was a full 6 feet tall, erect gait, majestic aspect. His manners were uncommonly bland and courteous, and his noble heart full of the love of God and mankind. When he went to Haverville, the Congregational Church had just divided upon the subject of new and old light. One of the parties, supposing Mr. Smith to be a Peter Baptist minister, invited him to preach. They were all delighted with him and wished to settle him in their, as their minister right off. But he informed them that he was a Baptist, and that this soon turned into the tide of affairs, and their administration gave way to contempt and their love to hatred. They could not even bear his presence, and the select men of the town commissioned an officer to warn him out of the place. The poor man who was sent to read the notice was awed by Mrs. Smith's dignified person, that he could not read it, but trembling, stammered out, "I warn you of God's earth." "Why, man," said the doctor, "where shall I go? To the Isle of the Shoals, if you have a mind to," replied the man, and then ran off. Mrs. Smith did not obey the lordly mandate of his Peter Baptist inquisitors, but continued to preach the gospel, treated everyone with kindness and courtesy, and treated the opposition in the spirit of Christian love, and finally overcame it. He was never known to say an unkind word or meet the abusive conduct of his enemies except with generous allowance and compassion. He was a chaplain in the Revolutionary War, in the Revolutionary Army, and gained the esteem of the officers and men. His preaching was truly evangelical, rich, and impressive. He was a great friend to ministerial education and advocated the doctrine of giving pastors and preachers an adequate support and sentiments exceedingly unpopular, in that they didn't believe in paying pastors, they're too tight. He never disputed or contended about his opinions, but would state them calmly, deliberately, and kindly, and quoting the words of God as his authority, then leave them to produce their own effect. God take care of them. Let your spirit do its job. He was preeminently a godly man. There was a heavenliness in his conversation which at once interested and delighted. His labors were greatly blessed, in the conversion of souls, and he died in 1804, universally beloved and lamented. The Reverend Samuel Rogers of Philadelphia was one of the foremost preachers of his day. He was appointed chaplain of a brigade of legislature. David Jones followed Gates through two campaigns. John Gaino, remember that name, John Gaino, was the foremost chaplain in the American Revolution. As a minister of Christ, he shone like a star, first magnitude in the American churches, and moved widely and extended in field of action. He was a Huguenot by extraction. He was born in Hopewell, New Jersey, on July the 22nd in 1727. He was in person, says Dr. Furman, below the middle stature, and when young, of slender form, but a firm and rigorous constitution, well fitted for performing active service with ease and for suffering labors and privations with consistency. In the more advanced stages of his life, his body tended to corpulency, but not such as degree as to burden or render him inactive. His presence was manly, open, and engaging. His voice was strong and commanding, yet agreeable and capable of all of those inflections which are suited to express either the strong or tender emotions of an intellect, feeling, and mind. In mental endowments and acquired abilities, he appeared highly respectable. With clear conception and penetrating discernment, he formed readily a correct judgment of men and things. His acquaintance with the learned languages and science did not commence till he arrived at manhood, and was obtained chiefly by private instruction, but under the direction of a clerical gentleman, well qualified to the office. To the refinements of learning he did not aspire. His chief desire was such as to competent an acquaintance with his principles, and would enable him to apply them with advantage to a purpose of general usefulness in religion. The most important uses of society, and to this he attained. Such was the trusted friend of Washington, George Washington, General George Washington. He was brave and true, made an indelible impression on the soldiers with whom he was associated. There were several other Baptists who served in conspicuous positions in various capacities. Oliver Hart was one of the foremost pastors in South Carolina. He was useful not only as a minister, but as a citizen, and especially in connection with the events of the Revelation. The Revolution. In 1775, he was appointed by the Council of Safety, which then exercised executive authority in South Carolina, to travel to a conjunction with Honorable William H. Drayton, and Reverend William Tennant into the interior of the state to enlighten the people in regard to their political interests and to reconcile them to certain congregational measures of which they were disposed to complain. He was very impassioned in his personality. In his person, he was somewhat tall, well-proportioned and graceful appearance, of an active, vigorous constitution before it was impaired by his close application to his studies and by abundant labors. His countenance was open and manly, his voice clear, harmonious, and commanding. The powers of his mind were strong and capacious and enriched by a fund of useful knowledge, and his taste was elegant and refined. Of his usefulness as a citizen, there is no doubt. To all which may be added to this, his usefulness as a citizen of America, prompt in his judgment, ardent in his love of liberty, rationally jealous for the rights of the country, he took an early and decided part in those measures which led our patriots to successful opposition against the encroachments of an arbitrary power, and brought us to possess all the blessings of our happy independence. Yet he did not mix policies of the gospel, nor desert the duties of his station to pursue them, but attending to each in its proper place he gave the weight to his political sentiments by the propriety and uprightness of his conduct, and the influence of it was felt by many in his presence. The story of John Hart, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, is pathetic. The father of Mr. Hart, says Cathart, was a man of courage and patriotism, and he raised a company of volunteers, which he led to Quebec. And with them he fought bravely in the Plains of Abraham against the French. The son inherited his spirit and was universally regarded as one of the best men in New Jersey. He was well informed on colonial European questions and thoroughly understood the inalienable rights of mankind. He was held in such high esteem that he was generally selected to settle the disputes of the neighbors, and who spoke of him affectionately as Honest John Hart. In the social relations of life, he was a man of great modesty and benevolence, and his highest ambition was to serve God and promote the best interests of his countrymen. He had no taste for political life, and in the conventions of his fellow citizens, he expressed himself by brave deeds rather than by eloquent speeches. He did. He put his energy where his mouth was. When he entered into the Continental Congress in 1774, he was about 60 years of age. He resigned from Congress in 1775 and became the Vice President of the Provincial Congress of New Jersey. He was again elected in 1776 and took his place among the patriots and heroes who sent forth the Immortal Declaration. It was issued on July the 4th, 1776. When first published, it had only the name of John Hancock as president and Charles Thompson as secretary. 2 days before it was given to the world, the British landed a powerful army in Staten Island. To impart greater weight to the declaration, it was signed on the second day of the month after its adoption by all members of the circulated extensive throughout the colonies. Mr. Hart had passed beyond the age of ambition and vigorous activity in the period of life when men voluntarily make sacrifices and even imperil their property or safety, but he considered nothing but his country's liberty. He owned a valuable farm, Gristsall, and fulling mills. He had a wife and family whose happiness and security were dear to him. His residence was in the highway of the enemy, and his signature was sure to bring down vengeance in a week or two. He knew that everything which he owned except the soil would be destroyed by his dear ones, and his dear ones scattered, and his life taken if by the providence of the evil one he was captured. And yet he did not hesitate to sign the Declaration of Independence, though it might prove his own death warrant. And though it could hardly fail to inflict heaviest losses and the most painful sufferings on him, the enemy soon found out his patriotism in the happy home of Mr. Hart. His children fled, his property was wasted, and though an old man, heavily laden of years, he was compelled to leave his residence and conceal himself. He was pursued by unusual fury and malice and could not with safety sleep twice in the same place. One night he was in the house of a dog for a shelter and its owner for his companion. Aided to the intensity of the bitterness of his persecution, he was driven from the couch of his dying wife, whose anguish he was not permitted to assuage. He built the Baptist meeting house at Hopewell and gave it the burying ground. A shaft of Quincy marble now marks his resting place, which was dedicated by the governor of the state. At the close of the war, a Congress of representatives from the states called to draft a constitution for the United States of America. The new constitution was submitted for and ratified by the various states September 17, 1787. There was much opposition to the proposed constitution, especially as it determined that there should be no religious tests. There will not be any religious tests. Being living in a state doesn't have anything to do with what religion you believe and practice. For a long time, it seemed doubtful that the Constitution would be ratified at all. The issue hung upon the action of two states, Massachusetts and Virginia. In each of these states, the Baptists held the balance of power. There were two currents of thought against the article and the religion, the one finding it excessive and dangerous, and the other insufficient and maimed. It was feared by some of the opponents of the articles that the power might pass into the hands of the Roman Catholics or Jews or infidels, even the Pope of Rome. One horrified delegate exclaimed, "Might become president of the United States." The opposition was particularly strong among Massachusetts, where the liberal ideas were combated by legislators. Other states were unable to find in the article a sufficient wide and certain guarantee of religious liberty, and therefore they proposed amendments. By January the 9th, 1788, a convention of delegates assembled in Boston, Massachusetts, from all parts of the state. The debate was long and the issue uncertain. Some of the Baptists looked down upon the Constitution with suspicion as not giving full guarantee of freedom of religion. James Manning, the president of Rhode Island College, was an earnest advocate of the adoption of the Constitution, and he had much influence on the body. He fully believed that on the adoption of the measure for future well-being of the country was suspended. They have to ratify a constitution to keep the country together. That's important. Being aware that several Baptist ministers were members of the convention and they generally looked upon the proposed constitution with a jealous eye, he went to the Boston and with a view to exert whatever influence he could to disarm his brethren of their prejudices and to bring them to act as he fully believed in the interests of the whole nation that the nation required. In this effort, he was seconded by his intimate friend, Dr. Samuel Stillman, who was himself a member of the body with two or three other very influential ministers. The question of the ratification was finally carried by a majority of 19. Just before the final vote, Governor Hancock, the president of the convention, called upon Dr. Manning to pray. And though the request took him by surprise, he fell upon his knees and offered a prayer in which patriotism and piety were most delightfully blended, and which left an extraordinary impression upon the whole assembly. On his return to Providence after the convention had closed its doors, Providence, Rhode Island, he met his friends with the warmest congratulations and could scarcely find language strong enough to express his sense of importance of the result which he had been reached. The opposition to the Constitution of Virginia was led by a strong and popular man. The people were about equally divided on the measure. The convention met in Richmond in June 1788, the Baptist and Williams Meeting House in Goshland County, March the 7th, had canvassed the Constitution and reached the following conclusion. Whether the new federal Constitution, which had not lately made its appearance in the public, made sufficient provisions for the secure enjoyment of religious liberty, on which it was agreed unanimously that in the opinion of the General Committee, it did not. The leader in favor of the Constitution was James Madison. This is one of our founding fathers, James Madison. And opposed to it was Patrick Henry. Madison and Henry had been absent in Philadelphia, and the candidate for Orange County was John Leland. It was a great Baptist county, and probabilities were that Leland would be elected. Madison called on Leland, spent half a day with him, and Leland came down from the race and supported Madison. He believed Madison would properly represent the cause. The celebrated lawyer, J.S. Barber, in a eulogy upon Madison and the credit of adopting the Constitution of the United States properly belonged to the Baptist clergyman formerly of Virginia by the name of Leland. And he reached his conclusion in this way. He said that if Madison had not been in Virginia Convention, the convention would not have ratified by that state, and as the approval of 9 states was required to give effect to this instrument, and as Virginia was a 9th state, if it had been rejected by her, the Constitution would have failed. And that it was by Elder Leland's influence that Madison was elected to the convention. Soon after the convention, which framed the Constitution of the United States, had finished their work and submitted it to the people of their action, 2 strong and active parties were formed in the state of Virginia on the subject of its adoption. The state was nearly equally divided. One party was opposed to its adoption unless certain amendments, which they maintained that the safety of the people required, should be incorporated into it before it was ratified by them. And the head of that party stood Patrick Henry, the orator of the Revolution and one of Virginia's favorite sons. The other party agreed with their opposition and said to the character and necessity of the amendments proposed, but they contended that the people should have the power and could as well incorporate these amendments into the Constitution after it was adoption as before. That it was a great crisis in the affairs of the country and the Constitution then presented to the people by the convention should be rejected by them, and such state would be in a state of a public mind that there were little or no reason to believe that another would be agreed upon by the future convention. And in such an event, so much to be dreaded, the hopes of a constitutional liberty and confederate and free republic would be lost. At the head of this party was James Madison. The strength of the two parties was to be tested by the election and county delegates at the state convention. That convention would have to adopt or reject the Constitution. Mr. Madison was named as a candidate in favor of the adoption for the county of Orange, in which he resided, Elder Leland. Also at that time lived in the county of Orange, and his sympathies, as said, were with Henry and his party. He was named as a candidate opposed to adoption and in opposition to Mr. Madison. Orange was a strong Baptist county, and his friends had an undoubted confidence in his election. He yielded to the solicitations and opponents of the Constitution and accepted the nomination. For 3 months after the members of the convention at Philadelphia had completed their labors and returned to homes, Mr. Madison with John Jay and Alexander Hamilton had remained in that city for the purpose of preparing those political articles that now constitute the Federalist. This gave the party opposed to Madison with Henry at the head the start of him in canvassing the state is his absence. At length, Mr. Madison was about ready to return to Virginia, and a public meeting was appointed in the county of Orange at which the candidates for the convention, Madison on one side and Leland on the other, were to address the people from the stump, literally from a stump. Up to that time, had but partial acquaintance with Mr. Madison, but he had high respect for his talents and his candor and his uprightness and purity in his private character. On the way home from Philadelphia, Mr. Madison went some distance out of his direct road to call upon this man, and after the ordinary salutation, Mr. Madison began to apologize for troubling him with the call at night that time, and he assured Mr. Madison that no apology was necessary. "I know your errand here," he said. "It is a talk with me about the Constitution. I am glad to see you, and I have an opportunity of hearing what your views are on the subject." Mr. Madison spent half of the day with him and fully and unreservedly communicated to him his opinions upon the great matters which were then agitating the people of the state of the Confederacy. Then they separated to meet again very soon, an opposing candidate before the electors Elector Stump. The day came and they met with them, nearly all the voters of Orange County, to hear their candidates respectively discuss the important question upon which the people of Virginia were soon to act. Mr. Madison said, "The vulnerable man first took the stump, which was a hogshead of tobacco. Standing upon it for 2 hours, he addressed his fellow citizens in a calm and candid and statesmanlike manner and argued his side of the case, fairly meeting and replying to the arguments which had been put forth by his opponents. In the general canvass of the state, Mr. Madison was not particularly a pleasing, eloquent speaker, but the people listened with respect to his attention. He left the hoghead, and many friends called upon me. I took it, and I went for Mr. Madison, and he was elected without difficulty. This, said he, I suppose, what Mr. Barber alluded to as a noble Christian patriot. That single act, with the motives which prompted it, entitled him to the respect of mankind forevermore." When the convention was assembled, Patrick Henry spoke against the Constitution with vehemence never surpassed by himself on any occasion in all of his whole life, with a power that sometimes was overwhelming. Once, while this matchless orator was addressing the convention, a windstorm broke out over Richmond, and the heavens were ablaze with lightning, and the thunder uproared, and the rain rained down in torrents. And at this moment, Patrick Henry seemed to see the anger of heaven threatening the state if it should consume the guilty act of adopting the Constitution, and he invoked celestial witness to view and compensate his distracted country in his grand crisis of his history. And such was the effect of his speech on that occasion that the convention immediately dispersed. But Madison and his party prevailed. The convention, when the final vote of ratification was taken, only gave a majority of 10 in favor of the Constitution. Only a majority of 10 in favor of the Constitution. How many of you learned this in school? 89 cast their votes for it, and 79 against it. In this manner, the Constitution of the United States was adopted. Already, it has been seen that the Baptists did not think the Constitution secured religious liberty. Imperfect as it was considered, Mr. Madison and the Baptists, the Constitution had to be ratified. There was a large opposition to any amendments. Many noble men were in favor of the union of the church and state. Massachusetts was wedded to an establishment. John Adams, her favorite son and afterwards president of the United States, was indignant that the Baptists addressed the Congress in Philadelphia praying for religious liberty. He wrote as follows to Benjamin Kent: "I am for the most liberal toleration of all denominations, but I hope Congress will never meddle with religious further than to say that our own prayers, let our every colony have its own religion without molestation." In other words, every colony should have a church state. As late as the beginning of the 19th century was a dream of the state church. Thomas Jefferson wrote to Benjamin Rush, "The successful experiment made under the prevalence of that illusion of a state church that on the clause of the Constitution, which while it secures the freedom of the press, covered also the freedom of religion and given to the clergy a very favorable hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity throughout the United States. As every sect believes its own form, the true one, everyone perhaps hoped for, was his. But especially the Episcopalians and the Congressionalists. The returning good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes, and they believe that any portion of power confided in us will be exerted in opinions to their schemes." And they believe, rightly for so, that I have sworn upon the state of the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the minds of men. Massachusetts did not ratify the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. The suggested amendment came from the Baptists. Denominationally, says Cathcart, no community asked for this change in the Constitution but the Baptists. The Quakers probably would have petitioned it if they had thought of it, but they did not. John Adams and the Congregationalists did not desire it. The Episcopalians did not wish it. It went too far, so far as for most Presbyterians in the American Revolution in our times, when we hear much about putting the divine name on the Constitution. The Baptists asked it throughout Washington. The Baptists petitioned it through Washington. The request commended itself to his judgment and to his generous soul of Madison, and to the Baptist, beyond doubt, belongs the glory of engrafting its best articles into the noblest constitution ever framed for the government of mankind. On account of his well-known views, there was much opposition to Madison in Virginia. Through the influence of Patrick Henry, he was defeated for the United States Senate. The congressional districts were so gerrymandered that it was thought that he could not be elected to the House of Representatives. Here again, the Baptists, believing in his integrity, threw their influence to him, and he was elected to Congress. On the general subject of amendments to the Constitution, Madison, in a speech delivered in July the 8th, 1879, and we'll get to that one in the very next class. We're going to find his amendments and his speech delivered for Congress, June 8, 1789. I hope you're learning that America did not just happen. It took a lot of work. Your religious freedom, your freedom of speech, basically belongs to the efforts of the Baptist people in this country. Winning the Revolutionary War had a lot to do with the Baptist people in this country. Remember when they took their swords and dipped them in their own blood and swore to never sheath them until the revolution was won. These are the people of God that stood in this nation for your freedom today. We must keep it with every effort we can. Our Father, we send this message out for your honor and glory. Please use it to instill in your people the values which these people stood for nearly 300 years ago. Father, I pray that you use it for your honor and glory. Thank you for these people that you inspired and you gave them courage, and through your Spirit you strengthened them to do what they did. Help us to carry on that torch today. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.